This is Dan Barrett. You are listening to the Oz Media Report. This week on the show, I chat with Justin Papps from PwC Australia. He's compiled this year's Australian Entertainment and Media Outlook 2020 to 2024. The report, now in its 19th year, examines Australian media consumers' habits and how they're changing. Where are Australians spending their money and time when watching TV, listening to the radio and music, consuming news and entertainment, buying audiobooks, downloading podcasts, etc., etc.? The report looks at consumption over the past year, but it also offers projections up to 2024. You can read the report yourself, it's available on the PwC website, but I'll add a link to it in the notes for this podcast. It's an easily digestible report, and it's a really great way to bust any preconceptions you may have had about the health of the local sector today and moving forward. I took a thorough read through, and I was left with some questions. Justin Papps from PwC, he got on the line with me and talked me through it. Justin, thanks so much for joining us on the Oz Media Report.
Hey, pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Let's start with the report itself. How big is the team that works on it? And I was wondering how long it takes to compile, who's it for, just maybe the bulk of it, like what's going on with it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I couldn't begin to name by name all the people that touched this report. I think the first thing to say is that this is a report that we look at all year because it's a sector we cover 12 segments and it's probably one of the fastest changing sectors as well. So we've got a team in our technology, media and telco practice that that keep an eye on all of these segments throughout the year. And then we have a steering committee of about five partners that work on it, plus a team from the assurance practice, plus my own team in the CMO advisory practice. So experts from across the technology, media and telco space, some from agencies, some from media and some long-term PwC people as well.
Yeah. So who's the actual report for? So, I mean, largely a lot of it's obviously promotional. It shows PricewaterhouseCoopers' sort of thought leadership position within the space. But is it something that actually gets provided in depth to people or is it really the report as I've seen it?
No, so we do two things. So first of all, to answer the question, who's it for? It's actually for the for a couple of different parts of the economy. So if you think about it on one level, one is for the media industry itself to understand how it's tracking and what the future looks like, what the pressure points are and where the opportunities are. The second group is advertisers. They need to understand how to best reach their audiences and they need to understand how that media is cutting through. So advertisers look to this report to understand what's happening across the sector. And then the last group that look at it are those that are looking at where investments need to be made to, you know, drive growth or potentially get a better return. So it's a fairly broad church that we speak to with the report.
I was just wondering how much feedback do you actually get from those various sectors?
A lot. Yeah. There's not many of these reports in market. So we get quite a bit of feedback, some constructive, some asking some questions around how we got to certain numbers, et cetera. And we're pretty transparent with that. Mm. I guess the key thing this year is because it's a special edition for COVID is we actually spoke to a lot of people in the industry because I don't think anybody singularly could have a strong view on where things were going and what was going to happen next. So we actually lean in quite hard to industry. Some of those people are our clients as well and share some of our initial thinking and get some of their feedback as we go.
So are there other more in-depth versions of the report provided to customers?
Yes. Yeah, so we actually have all the detailed data tables that sit behind this that we share with certain parts of the industry as well, because as you would have seen in the report, there's a series of graphs. We actually provide a lot of it free online because we think that it's important that the industry as a whole has access to this information. But then we go into private briefings as well for clients if they want to dig deeper into a particular sector, how we got to our specific findings and where we might have seen some other opportunities that haven't made it into the report.
Yeah, so you mentioned the graphs that are in there. There's a fairly substantial graph right at the beginning that shows the 2019 figures and the forecast of 2024. Now, something that jumped out at me was the revenue for subscription. So you've got TV and audio projections there both being fairly consistent between where it's at now to the 2024 projection. And I was wondering, the revenue coming through, is the reason for that consistency that you're seeing that there's a consistency of price that people are going to be paying? So a lot of these services are based on the idea that I pay $17 now and I get everything for that. And if there's like even a dollar fluctuation, some of the customers tend to freak out a little bit and don't want to keep on, subscribing to these services. So is the fact that we're seeing a consistent figure 5 years from you know, the first figure effectively, because that consistency is in place? Or is it maybe more that as more expensive propositions like Foxtel start to decline, you'll start seeing the people, you're starting to see subscribers adding maybe one or two additional subs in there. So you're getting to a similar dollar figure for revenue coming through, even if the landscape has changed.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things to pick up on that. So first of all, I think it's the donut charts you're referring to.
Yes.
So given they're a share of market, I guess that as the whole market grows, if you can maintain your share of it, your revenues will grow as well. I think what we're seeing for subscription TV, and it's an interesting one because you need to break it into two different sections. Mm. One is what's called premium box delivered. So that's the Foxtel product. If we look at that over the next 5 years, that's actually declining at a combined annual growth rate of about 7%, just under 7%. So one time you've got a down pressure on that share because you've got a decline in premium box delivered, but the subscription revenue is actually going to grow at 16% at the same time, which is the streaming services. So if you think about Australia at Sport for Choice, you've got, I don't want to miss any out, but you've got Netflix, Stan, Disney Plus, Binge, Amazon Prime. We've just had BritBox launch. There's so many different services in Australia. What you'll see on that is while subscription revenue share is only increasing a little bit, it's actually getting a fairly significant share of the pie as it goes. It'll be worth, you know, somewhere around $2.4 billion by the time we get to 2024.
Yeah, and that premium box figure, does that include things like Fetch, which tends to be bundled into other internet services, or is that seen as a separate thing entirely again?
Fetch gets included in the premium box delivered number. We don't count that in the streaming number at the moment.
Yeah, sure. Let's just stick on the subject of subscription video, because I think that's probably the most exciting sort of sexy part of the report. At least I think that's certainly some of my interest, where I'm very much a TV-focused guy. Now, in the report, you cite that Netflix is the most subscribed to service, followed by Foxtel. Now, Foxtel is obviously in a precarious position at the moment. You're talking about that declining figure of 7% every year. They're facing issues with foreign content deals drying up as international content providers start going direct to consumers globally. Sports under attack, with Nine getting more aggressive about chasing rights for free-to-air and streaming via Stan. Now, if Foxtel's premium product's being squeezed out of the market in the next year or two, potentially, what flow-on effects would that have to the rest of the subscription space? And I'm not saying that your report's saying that it's getting squeezed out, but if that happens, like, it is in a precarious sort of a position.
Look, I think there's no question that that premium box delivered, whether it's Fetch or Foxtel, it's on a declining trajectory, and that's because we're so used to the new streaming services. So I think the thing that if we look at what's happened in that whole sector, you know, Binge coming into market is, you know, that's obviously looking to capture some of that market, but also Kayo is starting to diversify the ways to get the content in front of people. So without wanting to comment directly on what Foxtel's business plan is, etc., I think there's mitigation strategies there. And Kayo has been exceptionally successful. If you look at that, notwithstanding the dip that they had when all of sports stopped, you know, they came back in at over 600,000 subscribers. Binge, by all accounts, although not formally reported, seems to be doing well from what we hear in market. But the competition is getting hot. I mean, even since we did put the last full stop on the report, Stan bought the rights to the rugby with Channel 9. And so I think what we're going to see over the next, you know, 3 to 4 years is greater experimentation using streaming as a delivery service and starting to think about how they can better serve customers. Because the thing that we've noticed in the global report, and Australia's just slightly behind, but in the global report, in the next 5 years, subscription revenue will overtake advertising revenue for the first time. And that means that you're getting more money going through subscription services than are going through ad dollars. And there's a huge implication of that, which is if I'm a marketer trying to get my product or service in front of a customer, it's harder and harder to get you reach those eyeballs. So what you're going to see is a bit of a mix of products in the market. KO are already playing with a freemium service, which is, you know, an ad-funded model for some of the sports. And we'll start to see more of that experimentation.
Yeah, just on the idea of subscriptions, I found an interesting part on the report where you were talking about Spotify, and you mentioned that 60% of Spotify users listen to the paid service. That's up 47% from 2019. So, like, that's a substantial number of conversions. And I was wondering if there was much data on how much the active unpaid listeners are actually using the platform.
We haven't got that data directly, but I'm sure Spotify would, insofar as they're pretty transparent with some of their reporting. I think what we're seeing is, if you take it at a trend level, is That value equation is coming out for people, which is they're going, I'm okay to see ads on certain things, but in some the annoyance is too much, so the opportunity cost is there. I'd prefer to pay, you know, $12 a month or something and get away from the ads. And that's why I think you're seeing the growth in those sort of products. The other thing too is, as we're starting to see consumer behavior changes, if I'm watching video, like I'm watching Netflix or Stan or something with no ads, when I go back into an advertising environment, it jars a lot more. And it's the same for streaming. If I turn on a radio, I get the fact that I'm going to get ads. If I want to listen to my favorite album, being interrupted by ads is probably seen as a greater inconvenience than it would if I was going through another platform.
Yeah. I mean, I was also thinking with Spotify, it might be to do with functionality, because obviously you get more sort of more of an in-depth Spotify experience going ad-free with Spotify than you do with, say, a TV competitor. So if I think about some of the US streaming services like Hulu, which we don't get here, but pretty much you get the exact same experience if you got ads or don't have ads, but it's just that you have ads or you don't have ads.
That's right. And I think Spotify is an interesting one when you look at how they're curating experiences for their audience as well, which is, you know, that given what they're now doing in the podcast space, it's not just about music anymore. It's, you know, it's much bigger to that whole listening experience. And I think the way that we tend to look at this data, not in the report so much, but the way we think about it is, if you take a consumer-centric view and you start thinking about what do people, you know, listen to, watch, read, or play, that's effectively how the media sector is divided up. Listen, watch, read, play. Because if I want to listen to something, I don't go, oh, it's time for a podcast. I'm like, I just want to listen to something. And then I go to the content versus the platform. It's like, I want to listen to Teacher's Pet. So I'll go to iTunes, you know, to a podcast on Apple. Or I want to listen to my favorite album, I'll go to Spotify. And it's interesting that go to the content where you want it is a very consumer-led approach. And I think the industry needs to keep that in mind and not lose the consumer as they start to, you know, try different things.
Yeah, that leads me to another interesting thing I found in the report, which was you've got there that 6.6 million Australians now listen to audiobooks, 55% are now listening to podcasts or audiobooks instead of music. And that got me thinking, if the increase of spoken word is increasing to that sort of a level, obviously that has a knock-on effect to the rest of the media industry. So there's obviously the radio industry, which generates a lot of revenue from music formats. So if people listen to spoken word a lot more, that obviously heavily impacts them. And also you start thinking about people getting a lot of news and information from spoken word, which then has flow-on effects to news consumption. And I was wondering if there was sort of much really being paid attention to where that flow-on effect really is taking place and what the effects of that may actually be.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things. It's actually quite a lot in that question insofar as come back to that listen piece as well around consumption. So if you look at the radio industry and what it's done is it's adjusted to this new format by having really three ways to market versus just terrestrial radio. So they're not reliant on live anymore. So what effectively started as a catch-up service is now kind of this is turned into podcasts, etc. And they've also got their live streaming as well on the web, and you can and there's a mix in between the two there. And I think what radio as an industry have realized is they need to continue to evolve, and so they've got different products and services out there. So I might listen to a breakfast show in the morning, I'll go back and play my favorite segments on a streaming piece later on, and then I'll listen to the full podcast at the end of the week, which has all the best bits. So I've got three interaction points now versus one. I think the other piece around consumption of things like news and content, we've got a, it's great from a consumer point of view in Australia, and it makes it challenging for a media point of view, which is being an English speaking market. We have all the podcasts and all the content from the UK and the US and anywhere else that speaks English. So the number of people I know that their catch up news service in the morning might be something like Monocle out of the UK, versus something local like ABC National or whatever, is we're kind of spoilt for choice. And what that means is trying to monetize then a podcast channel is really, really difficult. And so it's a bit of a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing for the consumer. It's a bit of a curse for media, which is with this proliferation of content and multiple providers of it, it's getting harder and harder to find the consumer where you want them.
So largely, if we think about the report, a lot of the reports focus on the revenues being generated within Australia for the Australian market. But if you think about this Amazon example, media consumption and the money that flows with that is global. And I was wondering, with the report itself, how do you tackle that? So obviously you can look at something like this Amazon situation, but then you've got other situations where you've got, say, like the New York Times, which has heavy Australian subscriptions to it. They do some reporting out of Australia now to try to combat that. So obviously this report is for largely Australian media and people spending money within Australia. But how do you sort of balance the, I guess, competing sides of that revenue aspect? Because you also have Australian producers who are producing stuff and selling that overseas. There's revenue being made, even if it's not being consumed here.
Yeah, so I think there's two key parts to that. The first part about revenue capture, et cetera, is we only capture revenue in Australia. And so it's what we'll look at is consumer spend. And we look for a range of different places where that goes. And, you know, we've got a range of different sources where we find that. And then the advertising spend, we rely on ad spend in Australia. So it's really just capturing that. Where the global context comes in is less about the revenue and more about the trends. So, which is what's happening globally and how is that impacting Australia? And so I sit on the global editorial board and get to hear what's happening in Hungary as much as I do China or the US or the UK. And we can get a sense of where is Australia in that mix. And Australia is quite unique. And so when we're trying to pull this report together, the global trends are useful information for us. We take the data we've got around revenue and expenditure, and then we look at consumer behavior somewhere in the middle and say, is this a trend that we're going to see long term? Is it something that's a spike? I think come back to one of the topics we spoke about previously, which is, you know, streaming services when it comes to, if we just take streaming video on demand. By all accounts, during COVID, when people stopped spending at cinemas and all those sorts of things, they upped their spend at home. So right now, a lot of households where they used to have maybe 2.3 or 2.5 streaming video services, they might have 4 or even 5 at the moment because they've thrown in a couple of extra. They might have had Netflix or Stan. They've now got Disney Plus. They might have put in Apple TV. They might have Amazon Prime. You know, all those sorts of things. Is the thing that we're watching now is not just from a spend, not just from a time spent point of view, but as JobKeeper stops, as the economy changes in March, you know, how many of those services are people going to be prepared to pay for? What are they going to keep? And I think one of the things that we'll be looking at, particularly in the new year, is household expenditure going to stay the same on these things? Or as cinemas open, we can do more things outdoors, all those sorts of things. Will people start to revert back to previous COVID habits, or will some of these habits stick?
Yeah. Like obviously the thing I would assume is that people are used to streaming now, so they might start looking more for BVOD options instead of necessarily going back to broadcast TV and ways that they were consuming stuff previously. Now you've got in a report that BVOD is expected to show some modest growth. So you got 15% now to 16.3% by 2024. And I think a fair bit about BVOD in the context of the US market. So there's been a lot of growth in the US market through what they're calling FAST services. So they've kind of rebranded BVOD from broadcast video on demand to FAST, which is free advertising streaming television. So that encompasses a lot of linear channels rather than necessarily things that are on demand exactly. So the best example of this is a service they've got there called Pluto TV, which is about like 55 plus channels of just like linear stuff. You can get a bit of on demand as well, but they're seeing a huge amount of growth there. So CBS bought that recently. They've made about $1 billion within a couple of months of owning this thing, and they really see this as a big driver going forward. And I was wondering, looking at the projections of 2024 to what's happening within the space now, BVOD in Australia is very much focused on the free-to-air networks and what we used to sort of see as catch-up services and what they're doing there. But looking at this US context with services like Pluto TV, is there much consideration given for that 2024 figure or about some of these overseas FAST services launching in Australia and how that might disrupt the market? So obviously we don't have it here now, so it's hard to really judge that, but I was wondering how you approach that.
It's a tricky one. I think there's a couple of ways to look at it. I think if you put the FAST services in the bundle of aggregators, so in effect they're aggregating a whole lot of content, whether it's, you know, advertiser supported or not. Mm. I think what we're seeing in the Australian market is, and this is where our digital adoption rate is actually quite good from a growth perspective, is I think the role that those FAST services are playing, we're kind of getting a hybrid version of that through connected television. So if you've got a internet connected television, basically when you turn it on, you put the menu down the bottom is a list of all those different streaming services, as well as the, you know, both the BVOD or the broadcast video on demand, as well as the SVOD services. And so the role that something like a FAST plays is kind of being captured through a connected television. Connected television penetrations just get increasing incrementally in Australia. It's kind of playing part of that role. I guess to come back to the heart of your question, yeah, or the way that I hear that is how much more competition can we have in this market? Because it's quite extraordinary. When you look at each of our free-to-air networks have multiple digital channels, they have, you know, they have catch-up services, they have their own broadcast video on demand services. We've got, you know, ABC iView, we've got SBS On Demand, we then have all this multitude of streaming products. I'm not quite sure how much room there is for a FAST, insofar as I don't think there's an unmet need for it to serve at the moment, because through connected TV or my own, you know, interactions through, you know, tablet or computer, et cetera, I'm kind of getting a lot of that at the moment. You know, I think the question to be asked is, you know, what need would that serve, and what audience could it address that it is, it's, that's not already being catered to? And I'm not convinced at this stage that there's huge room for that. I mean, if you think of something like what NBC Universal are doing, you know, what with their Peacock product in the US, it's going in under the 10 product here. So it's if that's an indication of, well, how are we going to play this market? I think this market's reaching a point where it's about that aggregation versus, you know, lots of new players.
Yeah. So I've sort of been thinking about just the expenses of running one of these FAST services. So if you look at Pluto TV, the CBS one, you look at Peacock, they're being run so cheaply with such a limited amount of actual expenditure on each of these channels. So while it sounds like 50 channels, like the other day they launched a channel which is nothing but Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley and Mork and Mindy on one channel. Like, how much money could that really cost to really sort of, especially since it's coming from the CBS archives anyway, like they've already bought and owned that content outright. So it's actually fairly cheap for them to be able to provide these additional channels. So I do wonder about the Australian market. You're saying how much can it really sustain? My question is, how much can it sustain when there's such a influx of such cheap content coming through, swamping out the more premium channels, would be the big question I have in my mind. And I'm not sure you've got an answer to that. That's me just really thinking out loud.
No, I actually think it's a really good question. I think the point you raise is a good one. And also the, you know, the example you use of Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Mork and Mindy. I guess the question for me is, again, I come back to who's the audience for that? How am I going to monetize it? And how can I demonstrate that that's a good investment for ad dollars, et cetera, if it's going to be ad supported? But also, I think there's a balance here between trying to monetize a back catalog and maintaining relevance with the consumer too. And I think where we've seen these services do really well is more along the lines of, you know, giving access to program content that may not be available on free-to-air. And I think locally, Ten have done that really well. And I know the other networks are doing also. So you can watch the US season of Survivor on the Ten product, which is not on free-to-air, et cetera. So I think there's always this balance now between new and exciting content and back catalogue. And if it's just a dumping ground for old shows, as much as I love Happy Days, I think there's a question there about the ongoing viability of a channel like that.
I mean, you have to realise it's all 11 seasons. Okay, so moving on.
Right up to jumping the shark, literally jumping the shark, where we get that term from.
There was one or two good episodes after that. So Australians paying for news is one of the big questions I have. 2019, it saw the local news market contract quite a fair bit. A lot of jobs lost, a lot of page counts in the newspapers shrinking. That obviously means there's less content being created on a daily basis for a lot of the news publishers. And I was wondering, do you think there's going to be much of a subscriber slowdown as consumers feel they're getting less value for money? And I think about this in a context that not only do you have the Australian papers competing for your money, but also we've seen a rise in Australians paying for the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and Washington Post. Like, there's so much money flowing out of Australia for news. That competition level just seems so intense right now. Where do you see this heading?
Yeah, look, I think this is probably one of the hardest sections to talk about, only insofar as it's just in such rapid transformation. I think the one thing that we know through any research that we've looked at is that the Australians' passion for, you know, for independent local news is still very much there. As much as they'll get news from other, you know, other overseas services, etc., they still like to know what's going on. I think the challenge is going to be how do you find a model that supports local journalism to a point that it's financially viable and you're still serving up news content that people are looking for. Now, there's a range of different initiatives that have been put in place by the news organisations to do this. But at the moment, I think it's fair to say that there's a little bit of holding of breath at the moment while we understand where the ACCC lands with the new code that's been talked about and where that puts the platforms, whether it's Facebook or Google or whomever, because in all of those conversations, if you think about the actual person that matters most is actually the consumer, they need to be able to find independent and reliable news any channel they choose to do it. And I just hope that we don't find ourselves in a situation where it's harder for people to find that independent news. The one thing we do know about consumers is they're pretty smart. They'll find a way to get the content they want in some way, shape or form, independent of any regulatory framework, I think. So it's a real challenging piece. I mean, everybody is doing their bit, I think, to try and promote local journalism. I know that the news organisations are. I know Google are doing some work in that space. Facebook are doing work in that space. So I think everyone knows there's a need. It's just, what's the commercial model that supports it?
Yeah. This probably brings us to magazines. So in the report, you mentioned that, and it's just a bit of an interesting tidbit, because I guess one of my big frustrations with the magazine industry at large, and it's been the case for years and years, and it's not just an Australian issue at all, but largely I feel that magazines have just done a terrible job of adjusting to digital. So if you think about it, like trade magazines, I think they've adapted pretty nicely. But I'd argue that a lot of the major magazine brands haven't really found like the way to transfer that sort of marquee like label. So like Australian Women's Weekly, like there's no bigger name in magazines, but they don't really have an online presence in that way, converting the audience over to digital. Within the report, you do say that the pathway forward for magazines post-COVID-19 is really to leverage the strength of those existing brands and diversify revenue through digital channels. But if they're not really doing a great job in digital anyway, like really what's the future for them to be able to maintain that going forward?
Yeah, look, I find magazines one of the most fascinating and frustrating segments as well, because if you think, yeah, it wasn't that long ago, Australia had the most magazines per capita on newsstands of any country in the world. So we were big consumers of magazines. And I think some just weren't fast enough to adopt. If we take the flip to your conversation around the ones that maybe haven't adapted quickly enough, there's some good standouts where they've done a good job. I think Better Homes and Gardens locally is a really nice example, which is they've got a good digital presence. They've gone into events. They've gone into products and services. And so they've found different ways to monetize a really good property. I think some of the other ones is it comes back to how well they understand their audience and what value they can actually provide to advertisers. So where it used to be much simpler in trying to get something in front of my customer, now there's so many more challenges. Is what's the proposition that means I can guarantee to an advertiser that I've got this particular consumer that meets this demographic and I know that they spend X amount of time on my site or consuming my content? And so I think that's the unanswered challenge for some of these titles. And some of them, I just don't think have translated as well to an online environment, because there's other people that own that territory, whether it's, let's take a men's fitness or automotive or whatever it is.
I was thinking men's health seems to be the brand that you'd think would automatically just work amazingly well through digital, but they just haven't quite made that leap.
Yeah, internationally they've made some headway, but yeah, I think it's interesting. And also, let's take a different category, like automotive, for argument's sake. So Wheels magazine, it's got a good digital presence, but if it really wanted to ramp up digital, they're not competing against other motoring magazines. They're competing against carsales.com. You know, they're competing against some of the specialist sites. So it's where other people are, other services, like a classified service, is actually providing news and content. They're pushing down into that space that maybe a Wheels might have owned previously. So now there's room for both, I think, but they've just got to find where can they get the best balance and the best value proposition for not just consumers, but also advertisers.
Yeah. Look, I thought maybe we could end the conversation on talking about the subject matter closest to my heart, which is free-to-air television. There was just a really interesting thing that jumped out at me, which you were saying that 18.42 million Australians are watching free-to-air TV. And that's down from 18.75 million the year before. So like that's not a massive sort of reduction, but it's a little bit of a jump down. And each year we are seeing it trend down more and more. But in there you mentioned a thing which just really jumped out. You said that the number of hours watched by people increased 2.2% year on year. You got fewer people watching the networks, but they're watching for longer. And I was wondering if the research indicated why they're watching longer.
Yeah, so I think that it's a good question. I think there's two things that we need to flush out with this. And that data comes from the industry, those particular numbers you just called out. I think that the fascinating thing to watch for TV, and it's probably one of the hardest chapters to write, because it plays such a pivotal role in people's lives, but it's evolving so quickly. And it's the one that's challenged by streaming and those sorts of things. But if we talk about the time spent, I think the interesting thing in 2019 and into 2020, people's consumption of news on television really increased a lot because it wasn't just COVID, right? We came out of an incredibly difficult bushfire season where people were tuning into the 6 o'clock news and they were staying for the whole report and then watching the special report from that was on the ground. So time spent was higher because they were seeking that live news information. If you think about the three real strengths of free-to-air have always been, you know, news, sport and reality, is that real value proposition around live news came to the fore. So we had bushfire season. People forget we then went into a bit of a flood season and then we came into COVID. Is free-to-air's value proposition was really clear at that point because people were tuning in at 6 o'clock to get the latest updates and it wasn't just what they'd seen online. So I think that's why we saw that. The challenge for them is that ad dollars didn't follow from a revenue perspective, and it wasn't because they'd done anything wrong. It's just advertising dropped overall because people were pulling back. They couldn't advertise for products they couldn't supply during COVID. But I think what free-to-air is doing quite well, as I said before, is pivoting into that BVOD space so they can actually start to get stickier audiences. But the other thing too is if you look at how many times they've sort of repositioned those digital channels or the secondary channels, if you want to call them that, that preparedness to experiment and reframe, I think is a good thing for the industry, just trying to hang on to those audiences for longer in the ecosystem.
Yeah. I was wondering if maybe sort of Sky News being played in regional Australia may have played a bit of an impact as well. So that's one of the few things that I could really think about the market changing other than what you'd cited, really, which is that the external forces, the awfulness of 2020 really sort of amping up that news consumption. I just figured Sky News, it was really available in regional areas. Services like Sky actually encourage people for watching for long periods of time.
Yeah, I think so. I think also during a crisis, what we saw, and again, it's anecdotal and we couldn't get the data we wanted to demonstrate it, but what we've heard through the market and also through, you know, own experience and things like that is during the crisis is people are more inclined to have the television on in the background as a companion to sort of, you know, what's the latest news versus just tune in and tune out. So it actually had a bit it had a greater presence, I guess, during a crisis, which is important, you know, and whether that's on an advertiser network or a non-advertiser like a national broadcaster, I think it played a really critical role for people during that period. It falls into the bucket for me, which is we talked a little bit about earlier, which is what are the habits that will stick post-COVID and what are the ones that have changed forever? And I think it's one of those things that we'll be watching closely for next year's report as well.
Yeah, look, absolutely. Justin, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate talking this through because this is a monster report. It is a bulky read.
It is. And it's as someone, one of my good colleagues, former colleagues rang me the other day, he said it's a two cupper read. He said it took him two cups to get through it. And I think if that's the currency we use for measurement, I'm happy with that.
Look, it was a seven cupper read for me, but maybe I just don't read as fast. Justin, thanks so much for your time. It's appreciated.
I really appreciate the chance to talk about it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks to Justin Papps for joining me on the Oz Media Report this week. If you found the chat interesting, I do encourage you to take a read through the report yourself, but something else you should do is leave a review for the podcast. It plays a big role in the algorithm telling people they should check out this podcast, and if your podcast app of choice doesn't support user reviews, hit the share button, tell your mates about it on social media, or email it to your nerdiest media-loving friend. My name has been, and probably will always continue to be, Dan Barrett. For more media talk, check out my daily email newsletter at alwaysbewatching.com. This has been a Televised Revolution podcast. I'll be back with you again soon for another Oz Media Report.